This lesson is entitled Leading Your Church Family Through a Building Program with Tim Christensen. Tim Christensen is an associate pastor at Lancaster Baptist Church, where he oversees the adult Bible classes and assists Pastor Chapel in many areas of administration. This lesson is a part of Spiritual Leadership Conference 2011, hosted by Pastor Paul Chapel and the Lancaster Baptist Church.
1 Chronicles 28, just so that you can have a biblical perspective for the local church building program. David is passing the baton, as Pastor Fisher so capably discussed this morning, to his son Solomon with respect to the building of the temple. And so David said to Solomon his son, verse 20 of chapter 28, "Be strong and of a good courage. Do it, fear not, nor be dismayed. For the Lord God, even my God, will be with thee. He will not fail thee nor forsake thee until thou hast finished all the work for the service of the house of the Lord." We know that churches are not the temple. They don't have the same spiritual and theological significance as the Old Testament Solomon's temple had. But God still uses buildings to see lives changed under the roofs of them. Pastor often says buildings don't change lives, but what happens in them does. And buildings really do become, and building projects really do become, an opportunity for God to show himself strong and for God's people to receive answers to prayer and to really be an opportunity for him to show himself mighty on behalf of a people. And so this is the house of the Lord. The Bible calls the church, the local church, the house of God. And so when we build a facility for a church, I think it really is a big deal. I believe that the devil hates it and obviously fights it. And we'll get a little more perspective here as we move forward. Verse 21 speaks of every willing and skillful man that's going to serve on the project, and we need those. Chapter 29, verse 1, "The work is great, for the palace is not for man, but for the Lord God." And really, our churches exist, not just the buildings, but our churches in and of themselves exist for the glory of God, not for ourselves. We don't build for ourselves. And then verse 2 speaks of the importance of preparation. David says, "I have prepared with all my might for the house of my God, the gold for the things to be made of gold, the silver for the things of silver, the brass for the things of brass, iron for iron, wood for wood, onyx stones, stones to be set, glistering stones of diverse colors, and all manner of precious stones, marble stones in abundance. Moreover, because I have set my affection to the house of my God, I have of my own proper good gold and silver, which I have given to the house of my God, over and above all that I prepared for the holy house." You actually, in these chapters, can see some great lessons on stewardship campaigns and fundraising as well. And one of them is that David led the way in giving offerings. And it all started with his affection for the house of God. One of the things I'll tell you with respect to these projects is you have to get comfortable before you ever start with the fact that it's going to cost more than you ever expected and it's going to take longer than you hoped. If you have some optimistic contractor say, "I think we can build that in X number of months," don't believe him, okay? And if you have someone say, an optimistic contractor or even an optimistic architect say, "You can build this for X dollars," don't believe them. Don't believe them. There's a lot of qualifying to be done when you have those kinds of conversations. Well, does that include permitting? And does that include fees? And does that include utility connections? And does that include landscape and hardscape and furnishings? And it grows. So don't be naive about it. Let's talk through the outline real quick. This will give us a skeleton and a framework, and then what we'll do is we'll take hopefully the second half of the session and just kind of use that as a springboard and jump from there. The roles in a building program, the roles. The first role is the pastor, and some of you are pastors in here, and my encouragement to you is don't let the building program consume you to the point that you neglect your walk with the God, your study, your family, or the compassion for the lost. Because those things are the things that need to be there and strong when the building ends. It's just staggering to study how many pastors leave a church after actually successfully completing a building program because they are just depleted. And that's not God's will. It would be absolutely better for the project to cost more and take longer and you to keep your sanity, okay? And to keep the pulpit with what it needs to be, to keep your marriage strong, to keep your health and your stress level low, and to keep out on the soul winning trail. Absolutely better for it to cost more and take longer. It's sad to me that pastors come under this burden that they this whole project depends on them, and they have to push through, and they have to push through. And I realize that sometimes these contractors, they need pushing, and I had to push a lot on some recent projects around here, and I'm glad Pastor didn't have to push. I had to push on it a lot, but I thought of that as a pastor. At some point, you just have to say, you know what? I need to have these blocks of time that are for these other things, and I encourage you with that. Letter B, the people. The people are obviously funding the work, and the people need to be involved in the work, and the people need to be led properly. We'll talk a little bit about that. Letter C, the project overseer. Sometimes when a church is to a certain size, the pastor, as he has here, can deputize someone to look after the project and to be the point of contact. Even if it's a godly layman or a deacon, I would encourage you to have someone like this. Letter D, the financial administrator. Letter C here at Lancaster is me looking after the projects. And letter D is Ben Hobbs. And most of you have met Brother Hobbs, our financial administrator. And we work together to see a project through to completion. If you have questions in the future, I wanted you to know who to talk to. Letter E is the building committee. We have about 30 deacons, and the deacons are assigned to committees. So six or seven of them are on the building committee, and each deacon serves on one or two committees. And we have a finance committee, and we have, I think, a security committee and a safety committee. And one of the committees is the building committee. And keeping that building committee in the loop and soliciting their feedback and bouncing things off of them and sharing things with them has helped us over the years, even just through email or periodic meetings. Letter F, ministry leaders. If you're building an education building, the ministry leaders in the educational department need to have some opportunity to voice some needs or requests with respect to how the building is going to end up. If it's a worship building, you need to discuss things with the leaders of the various ministries, the ushers and the choir members and so forth. Then letter G, the local officials. Some of you interact with a county government and some of you interact with a city government when you're doing a building. And we have done both over the years here, depending on the project. And I would just encourage you to befriend. Let me just write this down next to G. Befriend the elected officials, okay? Now, the elected officials, they're not the ones who come out and do the inspections and, you know, sign approvals and so forth. But the elected officials, really, in a correct government, the elected officials tell the staff officials what to do at the city level. I'll give an example. In the city of Lancaster, we have a council with five elected council members. The council members appreciates having a good relationship with the church because they know there are a lot of voters here, okay? So just practically speaking. And sometimes you'll get a little bit of a difficult person in the staff level of the organization. So we deal with the planning department at City Hall. We deal with the building and safety department at City Hall. We deal with other folks at City Hall. And sometimes you'll run into someone at City Hall who's a staff person. They're hired, they're kind of a bureaucrat, right? They just kind of work in an office and they're on the government dime and they're just kind of a bureaucrat. And they enjoy exercising their authority. They enjoy saying no just because they like saying no or saying that you have to change something. We did a little bit of a remodeling of our platform and someone liked that. Jim designed it and Alan built a lot of it. And we had a guy come out and say, now you need to have handrails off this platform. And we said, we've been in this building for like 8 years, we've never had handrails. All we did was change the finishes and the shape, and they said, oh, you have to have handrails. And it required a little bit of going above his head to make it so that we didn't have the handrails. I was just so beside myself when he said that, and I thought, this is terrible. We put all this investment into this, and now we're going to have to put these big pipes up the wall. And it worked out fine. But we actually had the mayor, who you heard from tonight, say to us one time in his office, what do you want with respect to this? Because we were having to do $1 million of road improvements, and it was going to be $1.5 million. And he said, what do you want me to tell him? And we're like, you have a say? And he's like, yeah, I'm the mayor. And they work for us. And we said, oh, well, we don't want to have to build these medians with all the curb and gutter and trees and stamped concrete and all that. We don't have to. He says, no problem. He said to his assistant, he said, go tell the folks in the planning department that the church isn't going to build medians. And they said, okay. So they went down and we didn't have to build medians. And we should have said, we don't want to build the road. But there is some reason there. And so it saved us $500,000. And it was because we appealed to the elected official. So I just want you to understand real quick, and I'm taking too much time here, but with the local city hall or at the local, and you need to figure out who the elected ones are and then go introduce yourself to them and make sure they know who you are and how many voters you lead. And the local officials, you have the elected ones, then you have the hired ones that are at city hall or at the county seat. And remember that the elected ones, they were elected by your members to represent your members. And they need to exercise. And churches, Christian Law Association helps with this often too. Churches should not be required to go through the same onerous requirements as for-profit businesses. We are not a developer. We're not making, you know, $100,000 per home that we sell. We are funding this ourselves and from the Lord, of course, but there needs to be an understanding of that at the city hall. And sometimes the local officials will help you with that. Letter H is the architect. We like him. Letter I, the engineers. I have appreciated over the years the fact that our architect contracts with qualified engineers and coordinates their work as a part of the building plans. Letter J is the general contractor. This is the person that you're going to enter a contract with to construct the building start to finish. Then letter K is the subcontractors. Some of you, instead of doing a general contractor, will do an owner-managed type of a project, and that can work under some circumstances. It puts a lot more work on you, and it puts a lot more risk on you, but sometimes it works for churches. Subcontractors, if you have someone in your church who's a qualified electrician, for example, but you have a general contractor that you've hired to build the building, you can ask the general contractor to give the subcontractor who goes to your church an opportunity to bid the project for him and to be included in the process. Subcontractors, you're going to build a relationship with them. Even though they report to the general contractor, the buck stops with the church as the owner. And then letter L, other consultants. I'm thinking of people like interior designers, sound consultants, lighting consultants, and so forth. Those are the roles. Number two, the resources for a building program, the resources. Let's talk about the finances for just a moment. First of all, consider the generosity of God's people. Brother Hobbs and I try to remember as we move through a project that every little decision or choice we make that potentially could save money or potentially could cost money could be the equivalent to something someone really sacrificed to donate. You know, we might make a decision on this building that we built 5 years ago, for example, and it might be a $5,000 decision that is small in comparison to the overall project, but someone probably prayed, fasted, sold things, did without, and really begged God to enable them maybe over the course of 12 months to give a $5,000 gift. And we need to remember that. Letter B, consider the importance of managing resources diligently. Consider the importance of managing resources diligently. And I think I've learned this from Ben Hobbs with respect to just being careful about every decision and managing the resources and trying to ask yourself, just because the contractor throws out a solution that costs a certain dollar item doesn't necessarily mean that there's not another way to skin that cat and get that corrected. Letter C, consider the expense of project planning. It really is wise to spend some extra time and even some extra money in a planning phase, whether that's to go visit other churches that have been built or whether that's to take some extra time and money to interview a couple of extra architects or a couple of extra general contractors. That planning process will obviously pay tremendous dividends once the project starts. Letter D, consider the opportunity for cost savings in a project. It's wise to have conversations with the architect and with the general contractor about how can we find savings. And sometimes a feature of the building that was quite discretionary, you discover that it's quite a high dollar item on the overall budget, and you are surprised to hear that the general contractor says that if you omit that, you could save a tremendous amount of money. And you thought, well, if I'd known that, I would have omitted it, and you can do that. So consider the opportunity for savings, whether it's using different materials or changing some configuration or building something straight that was intended to be a curve, you know. And sometimes you can find some savings. Letter E, consider alternative methods of construction. We've talked with Jim and with other contractors about different ways to build a building, whether it's going to be pre-engineered steel or whether it's going to be block or whether it's going to be poured concrete walls, tilt up, or whether it's going to be structural steel with a metal skin. But we've talked to them about different methods of construction and what the trade-offs are and what the potential savings are. Letter F, consider the management of contracts, draws, change orders, invoices, payments, and lien releases. We can talk more about that later if you have a question. I won't spend much time about it on it right now. Number three, the route of a building program. Let's talk about the process kind of in the way of a timeline. Letter A, the process of planning and design. Number one, we define program requirements. That's where basically I make a list and give it to Jim. When it was our gymnasium that we were planning a couple of years ago, we said, okay, Jim, we want to be able to seat 2,000 fans. We want three side-by-side courts. We want two fitness rooms, roughly 1,500 square feet each. We want visitors' men's and women's locker rooms and home men's and women's locker rooms. We want storage for equipment. We want a concession stand. We want a ticket booth. We want an office for the coaches. We want a conference room that looks over the court. We want, you know, so these are what we want. It's a list of program requirements. It's bullet points. And sometimes instead of trying to figure it out ourselves, just give him the list and let him get creative. That's why I went to school all those years. Number two, evaluating schematics and renderings. So the next step is for Jim to come back to us as the owner and say, here's how I think this lays out on paper. A schematic is kind of a floor plan that's preliminary phase, and then a rendering is what it looks like from the outside. And don't hesitate to have 5 or 10 backs and forths of changes and tweaks. And that's worth the time and the effort and the cost. You're going to be billed per hour for what the changes required in the drawings, but that's okay. It's going to pay dividends in the end when you have the right building. Number three, evaluating the floor plans and the elevations. Ask lots of questions. Try to picture it in three dimensions. Sometimes rooms end up bigger than they looked on paper or smaller than looked on paper. You literally need to look at your existing classrooms and say, okay, this is 12 feet by 20 feet, and these classrooms on this paper is only 14 by 22. Okay, no, wait, I was thinking we needed twice as big of classrooms. And you need to ask yourself those questions. Don't trust your eyes that it looks okay on paper without seeing what it looks like in real life. Number five, determining the grading and the utility plan requirements. That's a tremendous area that doesn't excite anyone that I would forget about if I didn't have folks reminding me that it was something we had to deal with. Number four, adding mechanical engineering plans. Number six, defining the finishes and fixtures. Number seven, defining the landscape and hardscape plans. That's planning and design. Letter B, the process of value engineering. Jim can talk more about this, but my perspective on value engineering is when I kind of am in that schematic or floor plan stage and I sit down with someone who might build it and I say, tell me what about this building that the architect and I have been working on is inefficient or is going to be a more expensive approach, and what ways do you think we could save some dollars on this project? And someone might say, go three floors instead of two, or go one instead of two, or go, make it longer, or make it more square instead of longer and skinny, or whatever it is. And value engineering. Or sometimes the contractor will say, well, you have a very expensive way that the engineer has said that he wants to do this part of the structure or that part of the structure, and if you change this, you won't need to do that. Letter C, the process of bidding and contracting. I think this is one of the most important things, maybe one of the most important parts of the project is soliciting bids. And if you want one, I'll get it for you. You just need to email me and let me know, or let me know after the session. We provide bid instructions to our potential bidders. We usually get three or four contractors to bid our projects. I did this session a year ago, and someone told me that he had, I think 34 contractors show up to a meeting to receive bid instructions, and only 8 or 10 of them ended up bringing bids in, but that was 8 or 10 that they had to choose from, and they whittled that down, and they chose a contractor, and they've been very happy with it. But we send a letter to the folks that we want to bid from, and we tell them what we expect, and Jim helped us with the wording of that, and I can give you the kind of the template that we use for that. There are a couple of kinds of contracts you can use, and I'll tell you which one we use. Sometimes contractors refer to a guaranteed max bid, or sometimes they'll call this a not to exceed bid. The other kind of a bid sometimes is a stipulated sum or a lump sum, sometimes called. And then three, a negotiated fee. Now, this would be if you hire a general contractor, okay? This is not if you're managing it yourself. A negotiated fee is when the contractor is going to basically just charge you exactly what the subs are charging him, and then he's going to tack 4% onto it for profit and 2% onto it for overhead and 1% onto it for insurance or whatever he's going to do. And it's just you negotiate that fee and you figure it out. A lot of times this is something that's easier to do down the road once you've become familiar with what those portions of the budget should cost and you become real, real comfortable with the contractor. The guaranteed max is going to be the highest cost to get into the contract. This is going to be the lowest. But what you need to know is this one also has the least risk. Okay, so this has a lower risk, whereas this one has a much higher risk. And where the risk comes is in the unknowns. Okay, sometimes you just don't know stuff until you start building it, even though the plans are 100 pages long. And you find out something is not going to work. And so those things can be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% of a project. And on a $2 million project, if you have a $200,000 worth of stuff that you didn't figure out until you got into it, that can be a big, big deal for a church. So this is the contract that we've been doing with the contractor we've used on the last few projects, and this is how we ask them to prepare their bids, and then we're able to compare those bids among one another. The guaranteed max, what the contractor does is the contractor builds in some serious cushion, because what they're saying is, no matter what we find out during construction, this is all it's going to cost you. That's some good insurance, but he's padding that puppy with 5 to 10% of what-if money. The stipulated sum is going to be a line item budget for the areas of construction, and he's going to outline what his fees are as well in that. And then you're going to deal with things as they come. And if it's something that he wasn't expecting but that was very apparent on the drawings, then he's got to do it. But if it's something where the architect made a mistake, which we don't have to deal with around here, then that's something that the church is going to deal with. So a stipulated sum contract. And then the negotiated fee, there's no what-if money, there's no cushion. It's just he's going to pass the bills along to us, and we're going to pay them as they come in, and we're going to pay his fee as well. But this is going to increase the risk for us when it comes to unknown. Okay? Letter D. Yes, sir?
In the last one, that sounds like a cost-plus contract, a federal contracting.
Cost-plus is a good way to put this. Yeah.
What encourages him to keep his costs down if he gets a fee on top of whatever those costs happen to be?
We require competitiveness from the subs. So if he competes the subs, then we know we're getting the lowest bid from the subs.
So you're seeing all the
yeah, we see that in this one you'd only do this if you required competitive bids among the subs and you saw the subs contracts. For sure. Good question. Okay, next. Approval and permitting, letter D. Approval and permitting. This is going to take longer than you expected as well. And you're just going to have to work with your city before you ever start telling your church, we're going to break ground on this day or we're going to break ground on that day. Start asking the city, how long does it usually take right now for plans to get checked? And we're in a slow time right now, and so it happens a little faster. Letter E, the process of construction and progress oversight. The process of construction and progress oversight. And during that period of time, that's when all the stress comes, and that's when You're going to have a lot on your plate and a lot to deal with. You're going to have some things you need to do. You're also going to have to check on what other folks have been asked to do. You're going to have to meet with folks probably on a weekly basis at least, and as the project moves past the halfway point, probably multiple times a week, and evaluate the work of others, do job walks, get church members, get the building committee involved, and the process of construction. Letter F, the process of furnishing and outfitting the building. The process of furnishing and outfitting the building. And that's one that you have to, before you start telling the church, one of the lessons Pastor learned was don't get super optimistic when you talk to the church before plans are even done about, we're going to build this building for X dollars, because then when it costs 40% more than that a year later, there's a credibility issue. So you have to really upfront ask yourselves, whoa, how much do desks cost? How much do chairs like this cost? How much does furniture cost to furnish a building? Or pews? Pews are just astronomical. And so you need to upfront ask yourselves, how much is furnishing going to cost? Nurseries are not inexpensive to furnish. Kitchens are not inexpensive to furnish. So think about that and get the building outfitted. There's lots of equipment, lighting and sound. It should be criminal what they charge for sound equipment. But you need to compete that. And you need to get competitive bids and interview, and don't for a second let them intimidate you and tell you what you need and just take that. That's like going into a auto mall and letting a car salesman tell you what you need. Sorry, Reuben. You're a minister of the gospel now. Okay, the process of furnishing and outfitting a building. I want to turn it over to Jim, and I want you just to correct anything I said wrong. And share anything you'd like to share. And then I'd like to preserve some time so that they can treat us like a panel, okay? Come on up here. I'm going to hold this for you.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jim Bickle from Bickle Underwood Architects. We're, as Tim said, located in Orange County, Newport Beach. Been in business for 20 years. And currently probably working with close to a dozen churches. We're licensed in 4 states. Most of our work is in California, Nevada. And not necessarily coincidentally, most of the churches we're working with are independent fundamentalist Baptists, a lot of through the networking that we've done here. So I feel like I know a little bit about the program. A few notes I jotted down. I'll try to run through these really quick so we have a lot of time for questions and answers. But some of the salient points that Tim brought up, I think, could be elaborated on. First thing is this notion at the various cities or counties, jurisdictional places you'll be working with to get your plans approved. Important concept to understand is there's really two very separate and independent and sometimes adversarial departments at most of these cities and counties. You have the planning department on one end, which is concerned primarily with what I call quality of life issues. They're interested in you know, what makes the building look good and feel good and not disrupt neighbors. On the other side, you have building and safety, and what they're concerned with is life safety issues, fire separation and egress, and in California, earthquake and those types of things. And to a large degree, one doesn't care at all about the other, and many times they're contradictory. And to get a building ultimately approved, you have to go through both sides of this. And you always start with the planning side. And we call that the entitlement side, because you're going to go to the planning department and you're going to ask them conceptually, I'd like to build, in this case, this building, you know, a 40,000 square foot, 3-story building on this campus. It's going to, you know, have this footprint. It's going to look about like this. And they're going to give you conceptual approval to build that. They're going to give you the entitlements. They're going to entitle you to build that. That can take, in some cases, you know, every case months, but some cases years to get through that phase, depending on the complexity of the project. From that point on, then you go to building and safety. That's where you can submit the construction drawings, and then you have engineers reviewing it and so on and so forth. Again, that can take months to get through. So just important concept to remember, planning versus building and safety. There's actually 2 steps. Kind of along that line, one of the most important things I think that any church should do is master plan. Whether you know, are renting or leasing a property, which we work with churches on, and all you're doing is some tenant improvements, some interior work on it, or you know, whether you're lucky enough to have 70 acres to build over decades. In either case, there's still this planning where you want to look out way out on the horizon, you know, minimum 5, 10, 20, sometimes 50 years out on the horizon, and dream big. And what would you like your church, your campus to look like? And go ahead and design it that way. Then start scaling it back to, all right, what's the first piece? And you can go in orderly fashion, because one of the frustrating things for me, and I get called into a new church, and they're all happy, and they're excited, and here's what we want to do. And the first thing I tell them is, well, unfortunately, you got to tear down that, you got to tear half of that, and we got to move this road because things were piecemealed over the years or the decades without any master planning, and ultimately it's a shameful waste of money. So just word of warning there. Brother Christensen mentioned, but I would encourage you to, whatever architect you're working with, you know, get them to give you three-dimensional renderings. Some of you may have seen some of the animations fly through interior and exterior fly through animations that our firm did. It's a great tool in your fundraising. If you get an architect, we've got one church in particular I'm thinking of that I noticed this morning before I came out here. It was a 2004 job number on it. And we've been working with them for 7 years now. We haven't broken ground yet. We don't even have a permit because they've been in this fundraising and time's been hard. But in that time, we've been able to feed them with all kinds of material, and they've slowly been able to raise the money. And actually, as of May, we got the go-ahead to get the plans done and get them in for building. So work with your architect and get those kind of things. I think they're extremely helpful. In terms of value engineering, I agree completely with what Brother Christensen said. There's always more than one way to do things, and good architects try to stay on top of what the latest and greatest technologies and most efficient way to do things. But the real key to saving money and time on this, I think, is getting the architect and a contractor talking as soon as possible. One of the biggest mistakes that I see is either an entity, and we do a lot of commercial work as well and other types of institutional, and you'll get somebody that gets an architect and they get 90% down the way, or even in some cases they want to go 99% of the way, and they say, okay, now we're going to send this out to 10 contractors. And the bids are all higher than expected, and there's all these, you know, well, we should have done this, should have done that. Well, it seems obvious. If you get a contractor involved as one of the team members early, you can resolve a lot of that early and save time and money. And typically what I tell my clients, I don't think I've ever met a general contractor, especially for a decent-sized job, that isn't more than willing to donate their time and put together conceptual budgets on the project very early on, even at numerous stages, updating that budget along the way for simply the guarantee to be on the bid list. You're not guaranteeing them that they're going to get the job, and you know, you all have to shake hands and say, you know, if it doesn't work out, you know, we give you your shot. But just, I mean, this is not just in recession time. For 20 years, I've seen that. So get a contractor, get your architect or to give a recommendation, or if you have some, get them on early. The other thing I've seen happen is the opposite. Someone's going to build a building. They have a staff member, or in case of a church, you know, maybe a member of the church who's a contractor, and they get 80-90% down the way with the contractor, and the contractor saying, "Oh yeah, well we can do it. We'll just get, you know, someone to draw some plans at the last minute," and you get this whole thing planned. And then the architect comes in and starts pointing out all these things that, boy, if you'd have done this, you could have saved that. You could have got more efficient. You could have done all these things. So, to me, you want to get both on board fairly early. I think the ideal scenario is you get the architect on board first to start doing some master planning and some conceptual design. But right after conceptual design, right after you have the renderings and the schematic floor plan, get a contractor, take a look at it, give his ideas. And then the last thing before we open for questions is another thing that can save time and money is not just programming, but I would say good programming. Brother Christensen mentioned that on the gymnasium building that we have in design right now, he gave me a very comprehensive list of everything from how many spectators and how many weight rooms and fitness rooms and AD directors. The more specific and detailed you can get that list, the better fee you're going to get from the architect, the quicker you're going to get your plans, the happier you're going to be with your building. It's basically a written list. Don't try, I mean, if you're graphically skilled, I guess you could draw something, but you don't really need to. What you need to do is sit down at a computer and brainstorm with your building committee and create, you know, within reason, as long as list as you can, of your wish list for the building. And it can include not only space requirements, but it can include colors or information like here in Lancaster with all the wind. One of the things we talked about was we don't want any main entry doors facing the wind corridor. That was part of the program. So whatever I designed in this building and some other building I've got going, I knew, can't do that. It could be anything along those lines, you know, from weather requirements to views from a particular boulevard that you'd like, you know, maximum exposure on, signage that you might want to have opportunity for, you know, down to how many seats you want in classrooms or auditoriums or how many particular age groups and nurseries, how many nursing mothers you're going to have. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And the more you can give that to your architect up front, the happier you're going to be, the quicker it's going to go, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, I think I hit the high points. I mean, I could talk about, you know, some more design-oriented things if you're interested. Also, if anybody's interested, I could talk a little bit about LEED. I don't know if any of you are familiar with LEED, Leadership in Energy Engineering and Design. We're basically designing energy-efficient buildings, but, you know, whatever you'd like to ask.
Let's open it up.
I have three quick questions. Number one, do you, in some instances, the architect is like working for the general contractor. In other instances, he's completely independent. Is there a preference on which way that should go?
I'll tell you how we do it, then I'll have Jim give his perspective. We start with the architect, and then the architect is independent from the general contractor.
And that works better in the long run, you think?
How would you say? It's worked real good for us.
Yeah, the two basic systems are design, bid, build, where you have a designer or an architect design it and then it gets bid and built. The other system, generally what you're referring to, is like a design build system where your primary contract is with both the general contractor and architect simultaneously. Many times the architect is actually a subcontractor to the general contractor.
Right.
There can be some advantages to that if you know exactly what you want to build, if you've worked with that general contractor before. The thing you have to be careful about that is, in that case, the incentive to the contractor, he's going to sign a contract with you for, let's just say, $2 million. If he can, on his own, value engineer things, in other words, install things that aren't quite as high a quality, and you don't have the third-party architect, the independent architect, advocating for you, the architect's working for the contractor, there's really no one to say, hey, that door that you're going to substitute is only going to last 3 years, whereas the one we initially specified would last 20 years. So you really, it can save some money, but you have to have a lot of faith and confidence in the general contractor. It can be, unless you really have a lot of, you know, if the contractor is an associate pastor on the staff, maybe it'd be a good way to do it.
No.